702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
So some interesting stats divined by a finance ghost on social media today, pointing out that Pepkor spent about 1% of its operating costs on diesel, that number closer to 2% for Tiger Brands. And while it might not seem a huge amount, with a country where margins are under scrutiny, particularly in food, and where growth is hard to come by, these are very tough results for Tiger Brands. And Noel Doyle, the chief executive of Tiger Brands, joins us. A share price down in high teens today, Noel Doyle. The market really taken aback by the huge increase in operating costs and the inflation, the internal inflation, I suppose, that with which Tiger Brands is needing to contend.
Yes, Bruce, good evening to you and your listeners, and commiserations on the passing of your colleague. Bruce, I think, you know, the share price has reacted to the pressures that we've seen on our margins. You know, with inflation in our basket at 17% and volume slightly down 1%, you know, and basically on that level of turnover growth, one would have expected to have seen operating leverage, and we haven't had any. In fact, our margins in percentage terms went backwards. So that really reflects, I think, both the cost push that we've experienced and where the South African consumer is. We're seeing many of our categories where the total market is in decline. So if you look at breakfast cereals, if you look at our grocery business, which houses, you know, the iconic brands, Old Gold, Coo, Mrs. Ball's, Cross and Blackwell, there we're seeing market declines over the last quarter of up to 9% in volume. And we've had our fair share, and sometimes more than our fair share, of that volume decline as consumers have actually exited categories, and those who've remained have started to trade down in terms of moving to either retailer brands or to secondary brands. So it's been a very tough environment for us. And clearly, we have not been agile enough and nimble enough and responsive enough in terms of getting our costs in line with the demand expectations. So that's obviously will be a big focus for us in the next 6 months.
The switch to house brands has been apparent if you look at the results of the big retailers. And do you make any of those house brands on their behalf? I mean, do you white label many of the goods that you do?
Very little house brands. We have some participation for one or two of the major retailers, but a lot of those products are imported very competitively against local manufacturing costs. And generally, you know, there's a history of retailers kind of been wary of giving too much of their business, particularly to the number one category leader in categories. But it is an area where, you know, we have stated our intent to participate, where we can do so sustainably and where we've got available capacity.
You've dug into your reserves to pay the dividend. Now, that seems like quite a high risk strategy, considering just how volatile and uncertain and unpredictable this environment is. Why was it so important for you to preserve the dividend at its previous level?
Look, I think if you look at our interim dividend payment, Bruce, it's a relatively small proportion of the total dividend. So when we look through on a full year basis, it gives us, we've got quite a lot of flexibility in terms of adjusting the final dividend if necessary. But we are in a position of having a very low level of gearing. And the working capital outflows that are reflected in the first 6 months, we expect to be able to wind those back progressively as we see inflation fall off. And hopefully we exit the winter with slightly lower levels of load shedding, which means that strategic stock builds can be unwound. Whilst we are in really good shape internally to continue to producing all the way up to load shedding stage 10, not all of our inbound supply is in that position. And so we've tried to build stock to cater for that.
What are you going to be doing differently in the current 6 months to try and mitigate against the first half slump that you've endured? Because clearly something's got to change. Costs are running amok in the entire economy, and you've got what's a 17% in internal inflation, which is massively significant. And you can't compromise in your brands. You can't take one of the 36 yeah. tomatoes out of the bottle of the All Gold because people notice that sort of stuff. So what do you do about it?
So, Bruce, look, we've got to go back to the drawing board. We had promised the market 500 million rands worth of savings, and we're on target to achieve that, but it's clearly not sufficient. So we're going to have to look even harder at our cost base. We're going to have to work very hard to squeeze out every point of distribution. Our bread business needs to grow in the general trade. And we have started to launch a range of products that fill the consumer need in terms of affordability, like our Kazi Magic sauce in the mayonnaise category, and we have a new offering in the tomato sauce category as well that will be a little bit more affordable for consumers. So we're going to intensify that and get our capex that will yield as efficiencies up and rolling. It is quite challenging because we need to make sure that we don't make very short-term cuts, and that, you know, when we go lean, that it's lean muscle, that we haven't cut all the way through the muscle to the bone. So getting that balance right, quite clearly, we can do a better job on that, and we have to do a better job on that. So you can expect us to up that target in terms of our cost reduction and just work harder in every single aspect of our business and try
your customers are taking huge strain. I mean, this is the reality. They are having to make very significant basket choices, aren't they?
You are absolutely right, and you can see that in terms of a shift. People are putting more carbohydrates in center place, less condiments and sauces. And cutting down on items that would have been normally sort of center of table and are now considered to be luxury. You know, I think we underestimate the impact that the second successive year of double-digit food inflation, coupled with the very significant hike in rates, has had on consumers who, if they're lucky enough to have kept their jobs, are probably seeing their incomes grow at 5 or 6%. And big chunks of the basket inflating way above that, and something has to give.
Noel Doyle, chief executive at Tiger Brands. Yep, they get up to cope with stage 10 load shedding. Their suppliers, however, may not be. So that could cause huge disruption, of course, in that particular frame. A huge story today I picked up in Business Day. Garth Tennyson doing a nice job on it, reflecting on a statement from Sanlam Investment Management talking about how its emerging markets fund is going huge in China and in Taiwan. The total exposure of this fund, if a fund's got 100% of its money, 37% or thereabouts going into China, more than 8% into Taiwan. That's a significant slug of investors' money being bet on a tiny part of the world. The asset manager in charge of that particular fund is Feroz Bassa. He is the head of global emerging markets at Sanlam Investment Management. He's on the line to us from Cape Town. What gives you the confidence to go so big into China right now? Feroz, good evening.
Good evening, Bruce. Yes, I think it's a bit of an exaggeration. China makes up 32% of the global emerging market benchmark, and it's not a tiny part. It's the second largest economy in the world. It's a big part of our index. And if you look at countries globally, China is by far the cheapest market globally currently.
This is all true, but at the same time, people have wondering about the future of China, the way China has been clamping down on its technology sector, how it was massively draconian in its handling of lockdowns with respect to COVID. And a lot of the trust that people had built up in China when it was growing at 7 and 8% in the early 2000s and continued its growth trajectory, slowing, of course, in recent years. But the wheels seem to have come off a little bit on the China investment miracle. That's why the tone of the question is, why do you have so much faith to put such a high proportion of the funds into that geography when there is uncertainty?
Yes. No. There's always uncertainty, and that's why the market is trading very easy. You go back in the 30, 40 years of China's history, we've had a few cycles, and we've been here before, and China was called uninvestable. China was called a number of things in the past as well. But if you just take a step back and say, well, you know, they did have the draconian zero COVID policy. You're right, Bruce. People were in lockdown for almost 3 years. They've also had massive clampdowns on the technology space and various other sectors as well. You've had a change of leadership. So you've had that instability. But all of that's now in the past. So, you know, China's come out and be more market friendly now. The zero COVID policy has been scrapped. We're starting to see the Chinese consumers emerge from that. And we know we've seen globally what happened, even in South Africa, the pent up demand that comes from that. Also, you know, if you look at all the statements coming out from senior leaders in China, They by and large done with all the clampdowns and all the policies related to the technology space. A very good example recently is in the last few years, gaming companies like you guys know Naspers by investment in Tencent, and also a company we own in our portfolio called NetEase, the gaming company. You know, they haven't had many new releases because they haven't had many approvals, but that approvals have started coming through more recently. Last week, NetEase produced results that were 30% above market expectations. So you're starting to see all those come through. And then also, I think more importantly, Bruce, if you look at globally, you know, we have a big inflation problem. We've seen it in South Africa. We had another 50 basis point hike. The Fed is hiking. European Central Bank is hiking. And inflation is not yet under control globally. China does not have that problem. They don't have inflation problems. They didn't overstimulate during COVID like the rest of the world did. So they have firepower to stimulate, and we're starting to see them do this in various sectors. And the bottom-up companies that we're starting to look at are producing results that are above expectations.
Okay, good news on that particular front. I'm also very interested in your exposure to Taiwan. Taiwan, 8.5% of the portfolio. Taiwan has been the subject of military maneuvers from China twice in the last year. China seems to be eyeing Taiwan in the same way as Russia had its eye on Ukraine, for example, and China sort of holding off on an annexation of Taiwan. I suppose it's not ready for a fight over that. But Taiwan feels vulnerable. I mean, yes, it is the factory of the world. Yes, it's a super electronic, super highway, super hub, brilliant, astonishing technology and opportunities there. But again, quite a high risky sort of environment.
Yes, look, Taiwan is, like you said, the manufacturing hub for semiconductors that goes into everything. I mean, every electronics we saw globally, when there was a shortage and supply chains were disrupted, the car companies, the global logistics, everything came to a standstill because they need semiconductors. And Taiwan is a semiconductor manufacturer for the world, biggest market share by far. Taiwan is also another very big in the index. It's probably 18% of the index. So, you know, we have a significant underweight and we are building in that space. Just to take a step back, I mean, if you look at China and the U.S. and Taiwan, there's a lot of posturing going on. Obviously, semiconductors are very important going into strategic components like military equipment and all of these things. So it's very fragile in terms of where it comes from. But if you look at Xi Jinping in terms of China and Taiwan and how he's handled that situation relative to what's happened in Ukraine, China is more at risk. China doesn't have the commodities like Vladimir Putin had. They're the manufacturing hub of the world. Also, they're the second largest. They're the second largest investor in U.S. Treasury. So, you know, if the U.S. must impose sanctions, that manufacturing hub
it's self-defeating, you know? Ultimately. So there's a level of protection. I think is the point. Feroz, thank you, Feroz Basser, the head of global emerging markets at Sunlum Investment Management. Wayne McCurry from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank is standing by for us in Johannesburg. A dreadful, dreadful, dreadful day on markets around the world, Wayne, and particularly on the JSE, where anything exposed to any sort of consumer expenditure was getting nailed. Tiger Brands getting obliterated 17%, Pepco down 10%, was miserable.
Yes, but those were, certainly Tiger Brands was very much related to their trading update. At least the annual results, I mean, these were a very, very poor set of results that they came up with. I mean, margins came under pressure. Cash flow was negative. They had problems in their rice and in their baby foods and in their consumer division. And, yeah, it was not a pretty picture at all there. And then Pepco, the earnings were actually down 17-odd%. But, of course, some of the other shares, you know, also went down in sympathy. Pick and Pay down 5-odd%, Spar down 4%. But Bruce, this is the time when opportunities arise in these sectors.
No, absolutely. But boy, you've got to have a very firm view on a potential recovery in an environment where that recovery is not obvious, Wayne.
Yeah, you've got to have constitutional fortitude. Yeah. You've got to be strong, yeah.
Exactly. Both of us want to say the same thing here, Wayne, but we're not going to say it. Yes, you've got to have testicular fortitude.
You're buying Pick and Pay significantly cheaper than it was during the worst of lockdown. You know, so, I mean, these shares are fundamentally cheap, and the time to buy them is when there is chaos and destruction and panic and capitulation going on in these shares, because that's when they're cheap. They're not cheap under any other set of circumstances.
So much of our fortunes depend on a recovery in markets and a recovery in the global outlook. And I was interested chatting to Feroz Basser just a moment ago, and their confidence that China could very well lead another global recovery. Because I've been looking at some commodity prices over the last 24 hours or so. And I mean, this year to date, coal is down 60%. Other commodities we produce, like rhodium, is down by nearly half. Palladium is down by 20%. What else do we produce? Iron ore is down by 5%. All of our chief export commodities are coming under a huge amount of flack at the moment. And that is also, I suppose, one of the reasons why the currency, you know, just cannot find support. We did hit another record low today.
Yeah. Put the Lady R, 1 rand on the side. Put, I don't know, Eskom on the side. What the Rand's doing is actually incredibly normal. We're in a commodity down cycle in a global environment of economic slowdown as a result of high inflation and high interest rates. This is very, very normal. Now, if normality continues, as you were discussing earlier on, then as inflation peaks and interest rates start to fall and global growth picks up and maybe China picks up a little bit more, all of those commodity prices will go up, and then the rand will strengthen, and our stock markets will go up, and we'll all start looking a little bit better and feeling a little bit happier, because this is a cycle. This happened in COVID. It happened in the global financial crisis. It happened in the dot-com crisis. You know, every single time there is a period of rising interest rates worldwide, commodities fall and the rand gets hammered. I mean, 2014 is maybe the best example, 2015. It just happened to coincide when Desmond was put in for 4 days.
Yeah.
But it is a cycle. Now, remember those days in 2014 when Desmond was put in for, you know, the weekend special was put in for that time period. We forget all of these things. I mean, the rand wasn't quite as weak as where it is now, but it wasn't far off. You know, it was 1880, 1919. You know, the world was coming to an end. What's going to happen? You know, the next stop in the rand was 1320. Yeah. We forget that.
No, and it's so important to keep that perspective, Wayne McCurry. Thank you. From Wealth and Investments at First National Bank, it is very hard to find the upside in the down at the moment. But yes, the Rand did hit 1987 at one stage, pulled back to about 1960-odd, still very close to record lows. Wayne McCurry from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank has seen cycles come and go. He's beaten them away with big sticks in time. And so, therefore, I think we should take his assessment with a great deal of gratitude. That's the word I'm looking for this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB. Absa's research team enables clients to make better informed investment decisions with strategically sound analytical advice. Absa's a registered FSP.
As with all of these very high level, we get to Dion Khos in just a moment, by the way, in London. But as with all of these very high level court judgments, they're very complicated. They're couched in very careful legal language, particularly when it comes to the Constitutional Court. Arena Holdings and Amar Bongani went to the Constitutional Court because SARS had refused to open up Jacob Zuma's tax files. And amongst others, Rob Rose, the editor of the Financial Mail, believed it was in the public interest that we should have access to information on the former president's tax affairs, because there is plenty of speculation that his tax affairs were, if not in chaos, certainly not in order. Today's Constitutional Court ruling, Rob Rose, what does it mean? Does it mean that your cover this week is full of the gory details of Jacob Zuma's tax affairs, or is there still water to go under this bridge?
Evening, Bruce. I wish it was that simple. Effectively, the judgment today says that previously there was essentially a wide blanket ban on getting anyone's tax information. This was, you know, covered by sacrosanct secrecy provision, and what the Constitutional Court says is that doesn't carry water anymore. So essentially it opens the way for us to go back to SARS and ask for Zuma's tax records between 2010 and 2018 again, and this time they can't just simply say to us, we're not going to give you the tax information because we just don't give people tax information.
So they're gonna have to give you some very firm reasons as to why not, because they've come out with a very carefully worded statement saying they're considering the application of the judgment in full. Commissioner wishes to note that taxpayer confidentiality remains fundamental to our administration. He's not going to bend over very easily on this one.
Except for the fact that in this case, what the court said is that, you know, under the Access to Information Act, you could access certain information like someone's medical records or defense documents, provided you were able to satisfy certain arguments that this is in the public interest and that the disclosure would actually is more beneficial to the public than the harm of releasing it. So if you meet those hurdles, you can get information, and that never applied to tax information. It now means if you can prove that it's in the public interest, you can get that information. So what Edward Keysford has said in that statement is that there's a very high bar to getting people's tax information, so they still believe it's confidential, and they still guard people's tax records, and they're not just handing out people's tax records. But the court does open the way for people's records to be obtained in certain circumstances where there is a public interest.
Rob Rose, thank you, the editor at Financial Mail.
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
I may get the emphasis on this wrong, but I've been practicing. A apoplitorismosphobia, I think you pronounce it. Is that even close, Dion Khos, Chief Investment Officer at Credo in London?
Bruce, to be totally honest with you, I have no idea, because I'm not fluent in Greek, but it sounded good to me.
Apoplitorismosphobia. Essentially, it is the definition of a fear of deflation. That's what it is. That's where prices go up really quickly, suddenly they start coming down and the whole world goes into deflation. The world is essentially beset by apoplitorismosphobia right now.
Correct, Bruce, but I think it's not actually the fear of prices coming down that is the problem. It is the secondary effects of that. Because right. I think if we talk about deflation and prices coming down, the typical listener probably thinks, you know, that's good. Quite a good idea.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is that if you just sort of cast your mind a bit further, if you're a household, for example, let's say you're a young couple, you're just, you know, setting up house and you need to buy white goods, you need a fridge and a washing machine and a few other items. If there's actual deflation in the system, and the item costs whatever the number is, 5,000 Rand today, but you know prices are coming down, maybe you'll sit with your wife and you'll say, listen, let's wait a few months, because maybe in a few months' time it's 4,900, 4,800, 4,500. And when does this stop? Because if inflation persists, then you'll probably never want to buy. Well, never is a long time, but you're going to delay it further and further. And basically, the demand side of the economic ecosystem dries up. It's not only this couple, it's everyone else who are watching prices decline and they're not buying anything. So what happens eventually is the economy contracts. The company that manufactures these white goods may go out of business. They lay off people, which then brings the demand side down even further. And so it goes on. People talk about the threat of the deflationary spiral. And that is why economists and policymakers around the world are very fearful of persistent deflation.
Because what we are seeing is inflation fall precipitously in several economies. We're seeing the USA inflation coming down. We're seeing Canada. We're seeing Australia. We're seeing Japan. Inflation is certainly on the way down. And that's a good thing. The rate at which prices go up is coming down. The question is, what happens if it goes over the edge into this era of deflation, which causes that demand side collapse? When last, if ever, has that happened in any meaningful sense?
Well, not in our lifetime is the short answer, Bruce. Not in any of the economies that we relate to, except for one, which is Japan. Japan, of course, had the mother of all bubbles at the end of the 80s. You know, there's the famous anecdote, which no doubt you've heard and many listeners would have heard, that the sort of square mile around the Emperor's Palace in Tokyo was worth more than all the real estate in California in 1989. That is how overvalued property prices were in Tokyo and, in fact, the rest of Japan. That was unsustainable. The property bubble burst. Prices collapsed by 90% or more. Banks that had financed businesses and individuals to buy property went out of business. And the spiral lasted for decades. So in Japan, we did see it. And because of that very expensive lesson in Japan, which was experienced right throughout the 90s and well into the 2000s, a lot of the Western economists, Americans like Paul Krugman, who won the Nobel Prize in 2008 for his work on international trade, for example, maybe one of the most famous modern economists, he and others have been very fearful of the lessons of Japan, and they called for deflation after the dot-com bubble burst and when we had the 2003 recession in the West. They called again for it 10 years later when we just came through the financial crisis. And guess what? 10 years later, here we are again, and people are calling for it. So what I would warn against is to take it too seriously. I'm not saying it can never happen, but all I'm saying is that we've seen these rumors before, and to date, we haven't really seen them in our lifetime. It's a little bit like I heard the back end of what Wayne McCurry said there about the Rand. You know, we've seen these sort of rumors of despair before, but it's not always gloom and doom. You have to sort of think through it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reality is that at some point demand starts picking up once again, that when growth starts recovering. Growth starts recovering typically when interest rates come down. And the problem with this interest rate cycle, the global interest rate cycle, is it's not coming down as quickly as people might have anticipated 6 or 8 months ago. Therefore, to misquote Thabo Mbeki, this is a dream deferred, if you like. We start sort of pushing out our expectations for some kind of recovery into possibly the new year.
No, correct, Bruce. And it's not only lower interest rates that will enhance growth and ultimately, I think, put a stop to possible deflation. There's many other tools. You know, there's the old truism that says don't fight the Fed. So interest rate is one of the mechanisms, but you can also look at the other side. You can look at fiscal policy. You can create demand by government spending. You can introduce tax cuts. You can print more money. You can have capital injections into the system. We remember recently the federal pandemic stimulus payments that they did in the US and elsewhere. There's all sorts of mechanisms that governments and central banks, any number of levers that they can pull to stop deflation, which has worked in the past. And my suspicion is it's likely to work again.
I agree. Thank you, Dion Gous, the Chief Investment Officer at Credo, on the line to us from London this evening.
WhatsApp Bruce
on 072-702-1702.
Have you still got those flicky fluorescent light bulbs in your garage or your house? There's a bit of a buzz that goes on with them. Or old-fashioned incandescent light bulbs. The light bulbs invented, I think, by Thomas Edison that we were still, certainly my house, we were using those up until about 5 years ago. Saved a fortune, though, with the rejigging of the lighting, and electricity bills plummeted as you put in low wattage light bulbs. And that was brilliant. Now, poll. News out of the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition that we will effectively ban the sale of fluorescent and old-fashioned incandescent light bulbs. It's a good thing, I think. There are new compulsory specifications that will ban the sales of these. Grant Patterson is the Managing Director for Africa at Heliogen. He's got many qualifications behind him in the world of electrical engineering. This is a good thing, right, Grant?
Yes, Bruce, very good thing. As you mentioned, the largest selling light bulb in South Africa is based on the technology invented by Edison almost 150 years ago. For some reason, the economics haven't played out such that people have stopped buying them. So actually, I think it's still the largest selling light bulb today.
Really? So but lots of people are still using them, obviously. And it's again, it's a legacy of fittings. It's a legacy of good quality light. I mean, you know, you get fairly inexpensive light from an incandescent light bulb. Why do we need to be rid of them, though? Why must we cast these things into the dustbin of history?
Well, the efficiency differences are quite remarkable. So an incandescent light, and for the listeners, that's the old-fashioned one with the glowing wire in it, consume 10 times more energy than an LED bulb. And then the technology that came out 25 years ago, the CFL, the compact fluorescent lights, they use twice as much electricity as an LED. So the efficiencies are obvious. The benefits are obvious. As I say, I think it's a lack of education and perhaps understanding that people haven't switched by themselves. And therefore, I think it's appropriate that the regulations step in.
The compact fluorescent light, now the CFL that you refer to, is that the same technology as those long tubes that you would get in sort of government institutions and in people's garages and things, where when you flick the light switch, you get a flickering light before you get a steady buzz and then a fairly warm, soft, generalized light?
Correct. They first came out in those long ones that you found in offices and factories, and then the technology improved so that you didn't need that starter, so they didn't flicker, and you could make them into smaller bulbs. And they were the original energy saver bulbs. So
yes,
if you walk into a store, you'll still see they're called energy saver bulbs, and they're by no means energy saving bulbs at all.
Well, not anymore. They were created. So, I mean, and unfortunately, transformation like this does take a lot of time. These specifications were first proposed in March 2021. The department has missed various deadlines on the regulations, but finally has published these things coming out now. It's probably going to take several years before these things disappear. Will it make any difference whatsoever to the nation's electricity consumption? Will we actually see a noticeable decline a year or two from now?
Yes, I think the regulations say that within a year that they can't be sold anymore. As you've mentioned, they don't actually outlaw the technology, they outlaw the inefficiency. So I think within a year, you'll stop seeing them on the shelves. You know, so the retailers and suppliers have got a year to run their stock out. And then it'll make life quite a lot simpler for them, because at the moment they're offering three options of the same bulb in three different technologies. So they'll be able to consolidate space, consolidate stock. The volumes of LEDs will go up, and we should actually see the LED prices come down a bit.
Yeah, because LEDs, the bulbs themselves are fairly pricey. Yes, they're much cheaper to operate, but the upfront cost of buying the thing almost negates the benefits of saving the energy, the expenditure on the energy, doesn't it?
So it's true the upfront cost is higher, you know, maybe double the cheapest incandescent, but actually, you know, very, very quickly, I mean, you opened correctly with your introduction, the electricity savings are significant, and not only that, the bulbs last much longer. So the economics favor incentivizing, in inverted commas, forcing you to buy the slightly more expensive one so that you yourself will save the money, will save electricity. It'll probably drop. If we could switch over completely, it's probably one or two levels of load shedding, which is the new unit of power. And so, you know, there's just benefits everywhere you look in these regulations.
Penny Langton has got the most practical question of all, however, on my social media feed, because she's got a particular fitting inside her braai, as many people who have braais with bulbs in them. She says, what bulb can I use? What globe can I use? Because we call those incandescent bulbs globes, and that's the one you stick in your braai. I'm sure LEDs must have that same sort of fitting mechanism, or we can make those LEDs with the same sort of bayonet fittings so that we don't have to rewire and re-engineer every house and every braai in the country.
Absolutely. So fittings are a separate set of regulations. So, you know, each fitting has got a name. You can make LED bulbs in any fittings, and there will be many brands available and many price points available. The variation within LEDs performance can be quite high as well, both in terms of life and in terms of energy efficiency. And there's other things that the regulations never used to cover. So there's a lot of electronics in an LED bulb, so, and flickering became an issue, and color is also quite important. And so the regulations, which just didn't exist in this dimension, just now make sure that when you buy a bulb off the shelf, when it says it lasts 10,000 hours, it does. When it says it's warm white, it is actually warm white. And when it says it's 10,000 lumens, it's 10,000 lumens. And when it gives its efficiency level, that's true as well. So the regulations were needed to make sure that the new LED bulbs, which are a bit more complicated than the old bulbs, had a quality stamp on them.
Thank you to Grant Patterson, Managing Director for Africa at Heliogen, bringing us neatly to Eyewitness News at 7 o'clock. After Eyewitness News, Zetu Damane, the Chief Strategic Officer at McCann, Joburg Heroes and Zeros, and she's got such a glorious hero for you this evening. It is possibly one of the more wonderful bits of advertising I've witnessed recently. Share it with you after Eyewitness News.
Bruce Whitfield.
Taking your calls on 011-883-0702.
Money Show brought to you by Absa CIB. Absa's award-winning research provides unparalleled insights for your business growth. Absa is a registered FSP. Zetu Damane is the Chief Strategic Officer at McCann Joburg. Heroes and Zeros time. I can't wait to get to your hero. Oh my goodness me. I haven't smiled and chuckled like that in a long time, Zetu. But let's wait on that one. And let's go to your zero. There's nothing at all but fruit in liquid fruit is what I remember about this one. I haven't seen this particular campaign. Why have they made you cross, Zetu?
They've made me cross, Bruce, because they didn't do a campaign. They just changed their packaging. And South Africans were shook because it was such a drastic change from what we know of the brand. So it went from very bright and colorful to a more toned down look, a lot of white. And if I look at where they've gone, it's very much in the space of where we see American brands, their fruit juice brands look like that. But as the market leader, Liquid Fruit taught us what premium fruit juice looks like and doesn't look like that. So, you know, packaging is like the most important thing. It's like the moment of truth. So we do the TV ads, the radio ads, all the stuff that we do. But the moment of truth is when you walk into the store and you pick up that brand. And if, you know, it doesn't, something goes wrong there. Basically, all your efforts were for naught.
I'm looking at the old branding as opposed to the new branding. I'm not sure that I would necessarily have noticed had I seen it on a shelf without the old stuff next to it. And the old stuff is very clear, as you say, very bright and very, very bold. I don't like the new branding. I prefer the old branding, but would I have noticed? I probably wouldn't have. It'll all, I suppose, come out in the sales as to whether or not customers are annoyed by the fact that their favorite juice has got a new box.
Yeah, so you wouldn't notice that it's changed? Does it look very similar to you, the two packaging?
No, it's massively different, but I don't know if I would notice. It seems weird, doesn't it? But liquid fruits, it's got fruit on the box. It's still the box that I don't know what happens to it when it goes into the landfill. I think it'll still be there 1,000 years from now. That to me is a bigger issue than the actual design of the packaging. It's the manufacturing of the packaging that bugs me more than the actual pretty pictures on the box.
Yeah. The thing is, you know, as consumers, we shop by color and shape. So if you, I know it's not something you're conscious of when you're doing it. So when you walk into a store and you're looking for cereal, looking for Kellogg's, you're not looking for the word Kellogg's. You're looking for that. Yes, you're looking for that. That orange shape of corn, this kind of box. That's why when Bocomo launched their competitor, they tried to look like them because they know we shop on color and shape before we shop on the words.
That's right. When they were taken over, when Bocomo was taken over, they brought Nutrific to the market. And Nutrific is essentially a Weet-Bix or Weetabix or whatever. Was it Nutrific or Weetabix? I can't remember.
Yes.
But the same stuff, just in different look and feel and different mouthfeel. And I don't, is it still around? Has it succeeded?
It has. It's still around. There is actually a nutrific, and you're right, they borrow the language of Weet-Bix in their packaging. And then there is also a Weet-Bix. And they're doing all that stuff on purpose because they know they want to confuse you in the shop.
Weet-Bix, of course, is what they call it in the United Kingdom. Yeah, Weet-Bix is the proper one made by Bokomo in the Boerland. That's where it's made. But I get it. So you're annoyed at the luscious packaging, the very generous looking packaging of liquid fruit of old school, and the slightly more, actually, as, now that I'm looking at it more and more, it's beginning to irritate me. It's a very bland, pale, pasty, second rate look, I'm afraid. Yes. Okay, I agree with you.
Yes. Yes. Second rate to us, but the bigger issue is not taking consumers on a journey. Some brands change the packaging over time. They're like, okay, we're first going to take out this element, then this element. So it's a gradual thing that happens. If you remember when Vodacom went to red, they spent over 20 million rands. And I kid you not, consumers were still going into store looking for Vodacom, not seeing the blue and walking out. That's how much we shop on color and shape. Yeah. So that's why they had to spend so much money saying Vodacom is now red. Otherwise, they would lose sales. So it's not communicating with the consumers and also not taking us on a journey to this new space that they've taken us to.
And it looks cheaper as well. And that's also such a it's more expensive and it looks cheaper. And that's also when you have faith in a brand and in the look and feel of a brand, and you get a shock change like that, you go, oh, is it the same? They've changed the box. What have they done to the ingredients? And maybe exactly the same ingredients, but your loss of faith in the ingredients. That's why, I mean, Castle Lager's genius metamorphosis of its brand over many years. I mean, if you look at a Castle Lager can from the 1950s, when they still had weird openers, they didn't have the pull tabs on the cans. They had a special opener that you had to punch a hole in either side of the can to get, you had to make your own hole in the can. That Castle Lager label is still very clearly a Castle Lager label relative to what it is today. But if you look at the gradual, the ever so slight metamorphosis of that Castle Lager branding over time, you won't even notice the change. But you look at the 50s versus now, and it's completely different but the same. But you've been unaware of the fact that this change has happened before your eyes and you've been unaware of it. That is clever rebranding.
Yeah.
We must get to your hero, because your hero makes me happy. Now, just the context of this, because we're seeing so much really clever advertising coming in at a budget, and it's all to do with script and performance, and it's all happening online. Just give me the context of this ad. We'll play it and then get back to talking about it.
Yeah. So in our world, it's actually, we call it content. It's not exactly an ad. And it's content from a little car dealership. And these ads are typically so bad. So we see them often with like AZ Motors car dealership, come here for the best price. And often think, oh, just go to an agency. But this one is really funny. And also it's rich in light, in insight. So I actually asked ChatGPT to please do an ad for me for a car dealership. And they actually did give me a life stage ad, but they gave me the typical life stages. You've gotten married, you've had a baby, you have more kids. But this one took a negative life phase, which is getting divorced. And they just created such a delightful piece of content, you know, that really stands out and is really fun.
Let's listen to it. Let's listen at least to part of it, because it's quite long.
Car buying advice for recently divorced women. Now, the reason you chose an X6 50D is because the personal trainer, the cute guy at the gym that you recently met, that you trust, that told you that your form is better than most 19-year-olds, said that this is a badass car. You do trust him, and he's good with kids because he wants to come and play Call of Duty on your big screen TV. So let's see what the benefits are of this car that Chad chose for you. This bad boy comes out with 20-inch wheels. Do you need tires that big? Yes, you do, because these will help you overcome all your insecurities.
Now, this bad boy is packing a 6.3-inch on the inside, just like Chad. And if you notice here, all the emotional damage that you had to put up with over the years, got your fair settlement in the divorce as well.
It goes on and on. But it's just, it's absolutely lovely, Zeto, in terms of really creative content in ad form, promoting the dealership in a way that makes you want to go and then meet the guy who's done the ad. It's lovely.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why, for me, it's a lot more scary than AI. So our currency as agencies is creativity, and AI just cannot do that. But content creators, for me, are away the risk less for us, because a client could go, I'm going to brief a couple of content creators and to create some content for me, and they can fix the elements of that didn't quite work from a traditional marketing perspective. So, for instance, he doesn't put enough emphasis on where his car dealership is, but that's easy to fix, right? Once you've got the gem of the creativity, right? So I'm saying, but
how much of this content is truly special, though? Here's the thing, Zeto. I mean, you can get professional copywriters doing a professional job, and you know, a large proportion of the time they're gonna nail it because this is their profession. Content creators, yes, it's their profession, but I'm not sure they're gonna get the success rate that perhaps you get out of an agency. Not yet, anyway. But you see the risk.
I hear you. I actually disagree. Like, we see a lot of we see a lot of middle of the road advertising as well. I think the proportion of middle of the road advertising and middle of the road content is probably about the same. I think the truly special stuff is rare. That's why you have a show called Heroes and Zeros, and only a few things come out as a hero. You know, because most of the stuff is typically just bland.
Yeah, wallpaper. Absolutely. No, most advertising is wallpaper, which is why the good stuff really does stand out. Zeto Damani, the Chief Strategic Officer at McCann Joburg, not a fan of the rebranding of Liquifruit. Certainly, once you've had a good look at it, you do start questioning whether or not the stuff that's in the container is the same as the stuff that was in the container when it looked pretty. And then Zeto's hero this week is a car dealership ad, and it's just the content aspect of it, just absolutely lovely. We've got really smart people doing really smart things in the world of content creation and driving customers to make decisions on that basis with clever scripts and low budgets. It's very, very smart.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
The Africa Business Focus is brought to you by SAA, the ones who fly SAA's growing route network, now flying to Blantyre, Lilongwe, Vic Falls and Windhoek. Diana Games is with us. Diana is the chief executive of the business consultancy Africa at Work. We got a new president in Nigeria yesterday. Feels like this happens often, and not much tends to change. Is it different this time, Diana?
Good evening, Bruce. Well, actually, it's too early to say. I think he's had the job for about 48 hours. But, you know, the concern is that he is from the same party as President Buhari, who many are pleased to see the back of. Bola Tinubu is the new president, and he has kind of hit the ground running. He is much more business-minded, much more sort of policy-driven, et cetera, than the previous president. So there are hopes that maybe things will change under him, despite the fact that he is from the same party and can put his own stamp on it. What he did in his inauguration speech is he actually declared the end of fuel. Sorry, my mind's gone blank. fuel... price subsidy, which is something that other presidents have been trying to do, have half introduced, backed off when the unions have gone crazy and so on. And so it's interesting that in his inauguration speech, he went ahead and announced the fuel price subsidy is going. This is costing Nigeria billions of dollars a year. So it's a huge cost that the country can't afford. And the economy, there's been a huge buildup of debt under President Buhari. So there's not much wiggle room for a new president to find different sources of revenue. So this is clearly something he's banking on to fund the kind of development and policy changes that he wants to introduce. Although the first thing that happened was that there were immediately, it was announced, fuel queues all over Nigeria, people panicking about whether the fuel was going to run out or the cost of trying to get it at the old prices, all this kind of thing. So it caused a bit of a panic on the very first day of his rule. There's also one of the big issues he has to deal with, which is affecting many companies, and I'll talk about it a little bit with Nampak, because that's also one of the big issues that all companies are facing in Nigeria, and that is the foreign exchange shortages, which are quite severe. And this is a consequence of the huge decline in oil production in the Niger Delta as a result of oil theft and insecurity and other issues. So as a result, because that generates most of the foreign exchange for Nigeria, as a result, that is right down. So this is a big issue for him, because a lot of investors are sitting on the sidelines thinking about pulling out, except now they can't take their money, or not going in. You've seen a lot of capital flight from Nigeria over the last couple of years. And a lot of it is based on the fact that this economic stability is threatened by this foreign exchange shortages. So the first meeting he had today was with the central bank governor. So it'll be interesting to see perhaps in the next couple of days if anything came out of that, because it does seem like he's kind of hitting the ground running, as it were. So time will tell. It's very early days.
It's all sort of, the noise is all positive. I mean, particularly when it comes to something like AGOA, and we are, you know, it's almost like we've pulled the pin out of the AGOA hand grenade and are now juggling with it as South Africa. From an AGOA perspective, this sort of seems to be playing firmly toward the court of AGOA, and that bodes well for Nigeria, I would think.
Well, they've just reaffirmed Nigeria's participation in the AGOA program. Of course, South Africa, Nigeria is not one of the big beneficiaries because it doesn't export enough. It can't take, like many other African countries in AGOA, it can't take full advantage of the trade benefits of that, because it doesn't export enough. Its main exports are oil and oil products, and that has been what it has been exporting to Nigeria. But it's nevertheless a positive thing. I think all of the things that you can put in place to support you as you're trying to turn around an economy that's in deep trouble, the better off all around. And of course, Nigeria doesn't have this kind of Russia, the problem, if you like, hanging over its head. I mean, it doesn't have the same kind of issue of supporting. It's much more neutral. It literally is much more neutral, and in fact has voted with the for the UN various UN measures that or statements over the period, and at the same time we have been neutral over those. So Nigeria has been far more proactive in condemning the war in Ukraine and etc. So, but nevertheless has strong relations, particularly with China and with India.
Whitey Besson at the Frontier Literary Festival was critical of ShopRite's withdrawal from many African markets. Nampak also, Nampak is a different story, of course. Huge debt burden. It needs to right-size its balance sheet. It is in full retreat for many African economies as well. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that one.
Well, that is the case. It's yet another story, if you like, a bit like ShopRite, where you're seeing a retreat of South African companies from the rest of Africa. In the wake of, you know, the continent has changed. It's gone through a lot of turbulence with the COVID and with the inability to really recover from COVID. And both of those, because of the Ukraine war, the high costs of food, et cetera, and the disruption to trade and all of that. But of course, that also coming off a low base in many countries, you know. So, and the common wisdom used to be, you know, spread your risk, or maybe it still is, across countries, you know. But in this case, I think maybe it wasn't. Maybe looking back, and it's all very well to look in the rearview mirror. The big expansion into Africa was around 2014 under André De Rota, who many people, of course, criticized for his performance at Nampak. But he was very gung-ho about the African story. And they did a lot of acquisitions and expansion in the rest of Africa. And I think they're in 14 African countries outside South Africa, and 32 in last financial year, 32% of the group revenue came from the rest of Africa, compared to 68% in South Africa. So obviously, I think the South African market is doing well, and what they're not getting is this huge exposure to things like foreign exchange shortages, currency volatility of moving money in and out across the border. And a lot of African countries are having problems in both areas, huge forex shortages, even the, you know, whether they're oil producers like Nigeria, which should be benefiting from the high oil prices, but doesn't have a huge refining capacity. And there's, of course, all the countries that don't produce oil who have had to import it. So there's a lot of issues that they're faced. And then, of course, we had the cost of logistics, of shipping on the back of the COVID pandemic. Shipping costs went right up. So there's large logistic costs, higher interest rates. And as a result of all this, there have been large impairments. And yes, their debt is considerable. So they are selling off assets in several countries, starting, I think, with East Africa and Nigeria. And the other one is Ethiopia, which is also experiencing major forex shortages. So they're having a rough time out there, I think, of late. I mean, I think things have changed quite a lot and it's hit them quite badly. So we are seeing another South African company, not pulling out of everywhere that it's in, but certainly pulling back. And they are doing well in some countries, their beverage can factory, particularly in the rest of Africa. So it's interesting to see, but you know, they have to deal with the debt, and this is one of the ways they can do it.
Thank you very much, Diana Games, Chief Executive of the Business Consultancy Africa at Work.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
Tonight's Investment School is going to sound a little bit like telling the guy who's just fallen off his motorbike to put on a helmet. But Jean-Pierre Verstaert, Chief Executive at Protea Capital Management, how to protect your portfolio while you're anticipating more crashes. Jean-Pierre, in terms of the real sort of calamity we feel like markets are in at the moment.
Good evening, Bruce. Yeah, it's been a sort of like a slow slide up until now. But to your question, I think over time and over a long enough period, there will necessarily be crashes. They are by definition something that events that you can't predict. But I'm pretty sure they will happen. I just don't know when.
No, this is true. At the moment, we feel like we need to protect ourselves, and I think it's probably too late against the precipitous drop-off in SA Inc. shares. What's keeping our market afloat at the moment is the traditional rand hedges. Some of our resources counters have been quite resilient. But generally, one looks at the South African retail landscape, one looks at the banking shares. They've fallen quite sharply so far this year already. I'm wondering if we're talking about that kind of protection or if we're talking more broadly about the sort of principle of protection into the future, if, and you know, once this sort of there's a bit of a recovery and maybe some stability in markets again.
I think the principle is applicable here. So I'll first touch on the principle.
Right.
I think in principle, you want to hedge, you want to protect yourself before calamity strikes, before the risk that you think might appear actually appears. So a while back, one might have been concerned about South Africa and the valuation of SA Inc. shares. And at that time, you should have protected yourself by hedging. Now, as you correctly say, I think SA Inc. shares are too cheap. This is not the time to hedge by, for instance, shorting SA Inc. shares. One can hedge yourself by diversifying. That's one way. But you can think about what the next calamity might be, what the next risk might be. And as an example, there's some weakness in commodity markets at the moment. And there's a view out there that maybe the opening up in the Chinese economy isn't going as well as people thought it might be. So there are always risks out there that one can seek protection from. The important thing is to seek the protection before the calamity strikes and not in the crisis. Because if you're looking for protection in the crisis, that protection will be quite expensive.
Right. So let's talk about the principles then. I mean, and we go back to the old-fashioned rules, these things that are not sexy, these things that particularly when there is lots of froth and excitement in markets and where Naspers is only going one way and that's up, and where Bitcoin is only going up. You say to people, you know what you need to do? You need to protect yourself against the downside. And they look at you as if you've had too many gin and tonics at lunchtime. And they sort of, and when you start talking about the importance of diversification, people's eyes glaze over. Why would I want to diversify when I clearly am an investment genius? Because look at my track record over the last 3 weeks. Everything's gone up. I'm brilliant at this investing thing. Diversification is the single biggest, I suppose, differentiator between people who make money consistently and those who go through boom and bust cycles?
Yes, I would agree with that. And it comes down to another principle, which is that the future is inherently uncertain. So if you believe that, and I think every day there are examples of things that happen that we cannot foresee and did not foresee. So if we come from that perspective, then the only way to protect yourself against things happening which you do not expect is to have a diversified portfolio. Now, importantly, Bruce, a lot of people will use hindsight bias and say, oh, but what about all these entrepreneurs, all these founders of businesses like Amazon.com or Apple, or even in the South African context, there's a few companies that have done very well. And if you held only that one share, you would have outperformed the market and outperformed all your peers. But that's saying it with hindsight bias. So if you don't know what the future entails, and not even the professional investors like myself, Bruce, really know what the future entails.
I've been rereading Nassim Taleb's Fooled by Randomness. It's a book that's 20 years old now. And he talks exactly to this point. I mean, you know, you start believing your own PR. You start thinking that you're cleverer than everybody else because you've had good success in investments, and you forget about the fact that the world is an entirely random place where bad things happen to good people, good things happen to bad people, and just, you know, life happens. And the randomness aspect of it, the things that you simply cannot predict in that unknowable future, is what catches everybody out eventually.
Absolutely. And that's why markets are the place that keeps everyone humble, because you might have a few successes in a row, but ultimately, you will get certain things wrong and you will have a drop in your portfolio. So again, whether you're an active investor, you pick your own shares, or you're a more passive investor, you buy ETFs or you invest in third-party funds, the point is that you need to diversify and don't get swayed by the fact that if you look at just how Bitcoin did or just how that one share did at the moment, it's Nvidia in the US. And if I only owned Nvidia, I would be so rich. That is the wrong way to think about things, and you're going to drive yourself mad if you try and move away from the importance of the principle of diversification.
And diversification happens in good times. Diversification doesn't happen in times of discontent and problematic markets. I saw somebody posting today, I forget who it was, but somebody saying, you know, diversification is not selling your South African shares at 21 to the dollar and at beaten down valuations, and then taking your money offshore and putting it into Nvidia, which is this astonishing success story of recent years where returns have been stratospheric and remarkable. That is not diversification. That's, I think, I don't know what the term would be, but it's equivalent to economic suicide, I would think.
Yes. So the whole point of tonight's discussion is protecting your investment portfolio, Bruce. And diversification is to protect yourself against things that are outside of your control. But you make another important point, and that is something that is within your control, and that is your own decision making. And what normally happens with retail investors, exactly, they are emotional. They normally make the wrong decision at the wrong time. I can't tell you how many retail investors have approached us in the last 2 weeks saying that now they want to take their money offshore. Now they're interested in investing offshore. They weren't interested when the Rand was 15 Rand to the dollar or lower, but now that we're touching 20, now they want to do that. So another important point of protecting yourself and protecting the value for investments is protecting your investments from yourself, from your own emotional decision-making. And that's a very important point.
What are you saying to people right now, Jean-Pierre? What are you saying to people right now? When they come to you and they say, right, the Rand has gone from 15 to 20, so we better get our money out of the country. How do you convince them that it's not going from 20 to 25 or from 20 to 30, which, depending on where you look on the worldwide internet web, there are many who are making those sorts of forecasts, predicting an Argentina or a Turkey-style meltdown.
Look, it's not impossible. So again, it comes to that respect for the fact that the future is inherently uncertain. So what I tell people is, firstly, stay calm. Try to be unemotional in your decision-making and try not to make any extreme decisions or extreme positioning in your portfolio. So part of the extreme positioning means that coming into the current rand weakness, hopefully you did not only have SA Inc. shares. You were already diversified. And if not, you can take a few steps, a few small steps towards better diversification, but don't go so extreme and sell all your Inc. shares and move everything offshore. So try at most times to keep a diversified portfolio, which will change over time. If your offshore shares have done very well the past 5 years because of rand weakness or otherwise, and your SA Inc. shares have shrunk in value, then you must relook at your portfolio or relook at the funds you've invested in and potentially rebalance, say once a year, to get back to something that looks a little bit better in terms of the balance between diversification. So that's what I'm telling people. Don't make any rash decisions and don't take any extreme bets in the positioning of your portfolio.
And the, again, very old-fashioned, time-proven, time-tested principles of long-term perspective and patience. Now, these are not things that we are naturally endowed with. Long-term perspective is like breakfast time tomorrow. Patience is, we'll do it yesterday. And unfortunately, particularly in difficult times, I suspect those attributes are in even shorter supply than normal.
Absolutely. And it's also a generational thing. So I'm getting this feeling that more recently, there's even less patience than there was in the past and less of a long-term perspective and more a need for immediate gratification, because we are so used to everything being instant, whether it's on your phone or even your meals, any entertainment you might want, everything is on call. Everything is just a push of a button away. And that means your investment returns should also just be a push of a button away. It should be easy. It should be quick. You should be generating 20% per annum, if not more, year in, year out. Now, part of this patience is to understand that that's not how markets work. And if it was how markets work, we would all be rich. And the market has this way, again, to humble all of us and to take away the money from those who are impatient and to divert it to the pockets of those who are patient. So when you have investments, Bruce, and hopefully people have got long-term investments, being exposure to equities, they do not move in a straight line. They go up and they go down. And sometimes they go down a lot. And it's only through having patience and maintaining that long-term perspective that you can ride out the ups and the downs. And over the long term, you will make a decent return, but only if you stick to it and ignore the short-term fluctuations.
And that's harder to do than it sounds. The idea of a reasonable expectation, and each one of us will have a different view on what is reasonable and what our expectations are, because all of us want to make the greatest amount of money in the shortest possible period of time, taking the least amount of risk, because we don't want to lose our money, but we want to make it. We want to double it in, you know, we want to double it in 5 years. And then we want to double it again in the 3 years after that, and double it again. And that sense of realism is, I think, quite a scarce commodity.
Absolutely. Again, let's take the interest rate cycle where we are now. If you look at how low the prime rate was only 18 months ago and where we are now, it's most people's installments, whether on your house or your car, have gone up by 50%, if not more, over the last 18 months. And similarly, on the positive side, your savings, your cash in the bank, the interest rate linked to that has also gone up substantially. And you can always refer to the interest rate you're getting in your bank account to sort of calibrate you about what is reasonable. And if you want to have zero capital risk, if you want to have your money in the bank where you know it'll never be less than the amount you deposited, then you know what the interest rate is you are getting. That's a taxable rate. And if you look at then the after-tax rate, that's an indication what you can then expect from the equity market, plus say 2 to 3%. And that sounds low, Bruce, and this is what most people miss. An additional 2 to 3%, broadly speaking, for the additional risk of taking equity risk, of having short-term fluctuations that can mean that the value of your equity investment can be less than what you put in. But that is what is reasonable. And if you put that all together at the moment, it means that low double-digit return, say 11 to 12% per annum, is a reasonable return. And anyone that promises you 20% or more is probably not making an honest projection of what your investment could grow to in the future.
And if they are delivering that return and they do it more than once or twice in succession, you really do need to be asking questions about how they're doing it and what they're up to, because we've seen far too many people caught on the wrong side of those sorts of arrangements, unfortunately, in recent times. This is where a lot of people get excited about hedge funds. Hedge funds are notorious about the fact that they historically tended to not really be hedge funds. Many of them were long-only funds that just took big risk and were well rewarded for taking that risk and charged very, very high fees for that risk. I wonder whether hedge funds, the role of hedge funds, becomes more accentuated at times like this.
So firstly, for those who might not know, the term hedge fund means a fund that can take leverage, and normally that leverage is via shorting. So you go long and short, you make money both from the rising price of an asset and the falling price of an asset. So different shares, for instance, to make money, whether they go up in price or go down in price. And to your point, when we have times like this where SA Inc. shares are down sharply, but gold shares and rand hedges are up sharply, that is fertile ground for a hedge fund. Hedge funds in South Africa have now been regulated for 8 years, since 2015. So in this time, in the early days, the type of criticisms you referred to, Bruce, you might have said they were valid, but now 8 years later, the cowboys that might have been on the fringes of the industry have been shaken out. And the people who are left in the industry, the long-running hedge funds, anyone can go to the websites of these hedge fund managers. They can see the returns of the funds. These are regulated investment vehicles, and they are generally above average, even after above average fees. And that speaks to the fact that the South African hedge fund industry is very healthy, and it's still, unfortunately, something that it's called under-indexed in retail portfolios. Retail investors are still a bit skittish towards hedge funds. But
explain what you mean by under-indexed, because that's a slightly technical term.
Yes. So if you look in the US, the size of the hedge fund industry relative to the traditional long-only industry, the mutual fund industry, which we call the unit trust industry, it is multiples larger than that relative size in South Africa. So if South Africa's broader savings and investment industry was of a similar structure than the US, the hedge fund industry in South Africa would be at least five times larger than what it is. More than five times more money would be managed by South African hedge fund managers than that are actually managed by them. So there's a lot of opportunity for the industry to grow in South Africa.
What is your sense of markets at the moment, JP? You've got a very successful track record. You've made a lot of money for investors over many years. You've taken some significant positions at different times in the investment cycle. I mean, earlier you intimated that South Africa is just looking insanely cheap at the moment. It doesn't mean it gets cheaper. It doesn't get cheaper before it goes up again one day. Where are you sort of, where's your mind?
Yes, so a few thoughts. The first one is that undeniably things are tough in South Africa. You see that every day with results, whether it's Pepco and Tiger Brands today or a whole host of other companies that have recently reported, things are tough. But there's a price for everything. And sometimes even the tough outlook that is realistic in terms of what might happen in winter and the rest of this year and even into next year is discounted into share prices. And I think we are roughly there, Bruce. So still being, like I said, not dogmatic about the future, having respect for the inherent uncertainty about the future, I do believe that there's a lot of opportunity in SA Inc. shares. Similarly, if you already have taken your money offshore, there's a lot of opportunity globally, but I don't think now is a good time to take your rands and exchange them for dollars. When it comes to offshore markets, Japan looks quite cheap after many years. Now, If you really want to have a fright, Bruce, I would remind a lot of listeners that Japan has still not reached the market high of the Nikkei index that it reached in the late 1980s.
Exactly.
So we're talking like 35 years of markets still not reaching the previous high. And that is why, again, a hedge fund, which can go long and short, is particularly interesting at times like this.
Yeah.
In the US, I think the AI movement is very strong, but it's probably in a bubble at the moment. If you look at the share price performance of NVIDIA and a lot of the other shares. So South Africa cheap at the moment. Offshore, some opportunities, but not in AI. And if you diversify across geographies, across currencies, it means you'll get some of these right, you'll get some of them wrong, but over time, you should do quite okay with your investment portfolio.
Investment School Headmaster this evening, Jean-Pierre Fester, Chief Executive at Protea Capital Management.